Welcome, everyone, to the teleclass, Norovirus Infection in Health and Social Care Settings. Martin Kiernan, who was to host this teleclass, is stranded on a train somewhere outside of London. My name is Paul Weber, and I will do my best to stand in for him. Our speaker today is Judy Potter. Now, Judy is the lead nurse and the Director of Infection Prevention and Control at Royal Devon and Exeter NHS Foundation Trust in the southwest of England. Judy leads a large group of a large infection control team that serves an acute care hospital and a surrounding group of 12 community hospitals. When I first met Judy about a decade ago, she was president-elect of the Infection Control Nurses Association, which is what it was then, became the Infection Prevention Society while she was president. So she is the first president of the Infection Prevention Society in the UK. She is exceptionally bright and a fantastic presenter, and I'm really looking forward to this talk. And so it is my distinct honor and my absolute pleasure to introduce Norovirus Infection in Health and Social Settings, and to introduce the one and the only Judy Potter. Judy.
Thank you, Paul. That's quite a build-up. Hello to everybody who's listening, and I'm really pleased to have been given this opportunity to talk about norovirus infection. It's something that the area that I work in experiences problems with every winter and in the occasional summer, and it has a huge impact on the delivery of health and social care in this area. The objectives of the session, I believe you already have, but just to run through them, first of all, we hope by the end of the session to be able to obviously recognise the clinical presentation of norovirus. I'll be describing the mechanisms of transmission for norovirus, talking about the impact of norovirus outbreaks, both on the individual patient or resident of a social care home, but also the organisation. And I make no apology for the fact that I'll be using my local experiences in acute healthcare as examples. And then finally, I want to discuss the interventions that are designed to control norovirus transmission, and again, look at how they have worked or not worked in my local setting. Just a recap, I'm sure that's all it will be for most of you, about the etiology of norovirus. It's described as a small, round, structured virus. It's a single-stranded, non-enveloped RNA virus, and it belongs to the Calsiciviridae family. And it's also known as Norwalk virus and Norwalk-like virus. And that obviously is because it was originally identified in Norwalk, Ohio, for the first time. It causes symptoms of gastroenteritis throughout the world, and is believed to be one of the most common cause of viral gastroenteritis. So, what are the clinical features of norovirus? Well, first of all, there's an incubation period of between 24 to 48 hours. It affects all age groups indiscriminately. It doesn't matter whether you're young or old; you can be affected by norovirus. Sometimes the onset of the symptoms are very abrupt, and that's often the typical picture of norovirus infection, but sometimes it can be a more gradual onset. Patients feel nauseous, they have abdominal cramps, they might have muscle ache, fever, headaches, usually a low-grade fever, but only in about 50%. And whilst the vomiting that can occur may be projectile, and again, that's the typical picture that most people have with norovirus infection, there are also many patients who have no vomiting and just suffer with diarrhea. So when you think about patients who particularly come into acute healthcare settings, but also elderly, frail people living in social care settings, this could describe any number of other medical conditions. And this is one of the problems with early recognition of norovirus. The route of transmission, there's multiple routes of transmission. It can be person-to-person through the fecal-oral route. It can also be transmitted through aerosols in the air, which settle on the oral or cavity or the mucous membranes when somebody vomits. If somebody has profuse diarrhea and explosive diarrhea, you can get aerosols from that as well. And obviously that also contaminates the environment. And then others in the same environment can pick up those virus particles, transfer them to their mouth, ingest them, and with a very high attack rate of often up to 50%, with just a very small inoculum, that can be enough to cause an infection in the next person. And clearly it can be foodborne as well. If you have a food handler who is symptomatic with norovirus or has ceased to have symptoms but returned to work and food preparation very soon after the symptoms have stopped, then food can become contaminated and from there spread to others. So why are small round structured viruses such good pathogens? Well, I've already mentioned the fact that there's this airborne mechanism with the aerosols, particularly when patients vomit, and that means that the virus can be effectively dispersed in the environment. And once in the environment, those virus particles are relatively resistant. It's been shown that norovirus can survive within the environment for several days. And there was a study from several years ago now in a care home where a carpet had to be removed after one of the residents had symptoms of gastroenteritis. And on removal of that carpet, it obviously disturbed the virus particles in the dust as the carpet was pulled up, and the carpet fitters then became infected with norovirus. And that was about 14 days after the resident had ceased to be symptomatic. As I've mentioned, it's a very low infectious dose. As low as 10 virus particles is all that's required for somebody to go on and become symptomatic. And you get very short-lived immunity with this virus because it changes. And probably one of the most significant things in settings where patients or residents remain in the same place after their infection has resolved, They obviously are still capable of shedding the virus in decreasing amounts for many weeks after the acute symptoms have ceased, and therefore continue to be a source of infection for others if hygiene standards aren't what they should be. When we think about the principles of outbreak prevention and management of outbreaks when they occur, outbreaks of norovirus, that is, the principles are the same whether it's an acute healthcare setting or a social care setting. The ease with which you can implement those measures may differ between the two settings, but the principles are the same. So when you have a single case of norovirus, what you want, first of all, is early recognition that that's what it may be, early identification if you have the opportunity to be able to sample and test, and whereas hospitals may well have that facility, social care settings may not. And it may be a clinical diagnosis in that setting. That individual person is going to be isolated or segregated from others who will be vulnerable to infection. But those, if there are already people who've already been exposed, then you want to restrict the movement of those exposed people until after the incubation period has passed, because otherwise they may in turn become symptomatic and pass it on to others. Environmental decontamination is important both during the period where the individual person is symptomatic, but also once their symptoms cease. You want to thoroughly clean the environment, and the recommendation in England is still to use a chlorine-based disinfectant for that purpose. Obviously, what I haven't got on my slide is the fact that hand hygiene is very important, and so is the use of personal protective equipment. I'm taking it as read that everyone listening will have appreciated that. It's important to communicate to other care providers if the person who has the symptoms, or indeed those who have been exposed to them, need to be transferred elsewhere, so that if they are transferred elsewhere, the right precautions can be put in place to prevent an outbreak in another healthcare or social care setting. Because of the 50% attack rate, if the first case has had contact with others, and it's highly likely that some of those other people are going to have become infected, and then you have an outbreak. So typically, your first case occurs, and within 24 to 48 hours, you will see other cases if that first patient has not been kept in isolation from others. And at that stage, you're talking about putting measures in place to prevent the admission of other people to that area, and also to limit transfers out, except for good clinical reasons, from the area that's affected by the outbreak. So it's stopping movement and stopping people moving to other areas where they may become symptomatic and spread infection elsewhere. So they're the principles, and it's really easy to say, and it should be so simple, but is it? And, you know, the key thing is small round structured viruses spread so easily in communal care settings, whether that's acute health care or social care. And these are some of the reasons, on the next slide, that highlight why it's so difficult to contain the spread. And I think first and foremost, I certainly see on a regular basis through the winter months where norovirus tends to be a particular problem for us, that identifying a single case actually can be tricky. Patients in acute care settings have all sorts of reasons why they might have diarrhea, why they might vomit. If somebody's admitted having had a myocardial infarction, they've got chest pain, they might have been given morphine to control the pain, and it's not surprising when they vomit. And we have been caught out here in my hospital on many occasions where norovirus really would have been the last possibility you would have considered, because there are good, strong other clinical reasons why the patient is having the symptoms that they have. It's different if somebody is admitted to hospital because they have gastroenteritis. They're the easy ones to spot and the easy ones to put control measures in place straight away. It's the others that are admitted with another condition and by chance happen to be incubating norovirus and become symptomatic after admission, and those where the symptoms just aren't thought to be typical of norovirus. Also, patients are infectious before their symptoms start, so you've got no way of knowing that they're incubating the virus until the symptoms start, but they are excreting the virus particles in their feces, and therefore there is a source there for other patients. And that's particularly important in hospitals like my own, where you've got multi-occupancy bays. In the majority of the wards in my hospital, we have 6 beds to a bay and shared toilet facilities, washroom facilities. And my hospital was built on a 1980s design at the beginning of the 1990s, which means that our bed spacing is about 2.6 metres from bed centre to bed centre. So very close together. The standards in this country now are for much larger bed spacing, but older hospitals are not required to meet those standards. They are able to continue with really quite small spaces between beds and, as I said, shared facilities. There's often no prodrome to norovirus infection. Some people do say that before the symptoms started, they felt a little bit of abdominal pain, they just felt a bit off colour, just not right. But sometimes there's no warning at all, and the first sign that there is a problem is the projectile vomit. The other issue, particularly in health and social care, is that norovirus, although it can affect all age groups, is likely to be more of an issue for frail elderly people who are much more likely to suffer with severe side effects of the infection. And of course, we have shared staff caring for multiple patients or residents and moving between them, moving between isolation rooms and other areas. And you're reliant on their standards of hygiene being exemplary in order to prevent spread. And then finally, in UK hospitals, I know that my hospital is not alone in the fact that we move patients around a lot. So patients come in through the emergency department. They may be admitted to a medical assessment ward. They may stay there for 24 hours whilst a thorough assessment is undertaken by a senior clinician. And then it's decided where they will be either discharged or moved to a specialty ward. So that's 3 departments within the first 24, 48 hours that an individual patient will have been moved through. In the winter months in particular in England, we all experience extreme bed pressures with capacity to admit patients a real challenge. And it's at that point where perhaps patients admitted to a medical division or directorate, medical unit, will be outlied into surgical parts of the hospital in order to free up acute beds for new admissions. So all of those situations mean that norovirus is really effective at spreading in these sorts of settings. I'm going on to the next slide now, and I do apologise for the fact that I haven't said that between my other slides. So there are some additional challenges in social care settings, and one of those is that certainly in this country, infection prevention and control expertise is often not as readily available as in a hospital. In a hospital, you would usually have an infection control team on site, certainly available in daylight hours, often with an on-call service out of hours. But if in a social care setting, they're reliant on phoning a local health protection unit for advice, which may not know the people that they're going to be talking to. There's no routine visits to those care settings from an infection prevention and control expert. And that means that there may be more likely to be a delay with the implementation of the most appropriate precautions. I think the other thing to bear in mind is that social care settings, normally it's the person's home, it's not a hospital, and the environment reflects that. The residential home or nursing home is decorated in such a way as to make it a homely environment for the people who are living there. So there will be soft furnishings, and therefore there is a difficulty with cleaning in the event of an outbreak. Patients in acute care settings are usually in and out of hospital so quickly that the days of having day rooms and dining rooms and activity areas in acute wards is almost a thing of the past, and but in social care settings, clearly the residents do sit in lounges and they eat in dining rooms, and care homes have activity areas for activities during the day. And obviously if a resident becomes symptomatic in those communal areas, then large numbers of other residences are likely to be exposed in one go. Now, as Paul said in the introduction, I'm moving on to the next slide now. I live and work in the southwest of England in a county called Devon. The hospital I work at is in Exeter. And the infection control team that I lead provides a service to that acute hospital, but also to all of Exeter and most of East Devon. It's about a population of about 350,000, and when we look at that population, we do have some interesting demographics around age. The next slide is just a record of the laboratory reports in England and Wales by the Health Protection Agency between the year 2000 and 2012, and I've highlighted the column that relates to the southwest of England where I live and work, and you can see if you compare the number of laboratory reports of norovirus to the Health Protection Agency year after year after year, the southwest is reporting more cases than any other region in England and Wales. And if we also look at the age at diagnosis, we can see that throughout the country, it's the elderly patients who are certainly the ones who are being tested, and therefore reports can be made onto the Health Protection Agency. So 75 years and older, much more likely to result in a norovirus test being undertaken, a norovirus being diagnosed in a laboratory. And that probably reflects the fact that elderly people are more likely to be admitted to hospital as a result of their norovirus infection. And the younger you are, you're more likely to manage your own symptoms at home, and it'll be over in a couple of days, and it's very unpleasant, but we all get over it. What I've been asking for the last 13 years, because I haven't always lived in the southwest and worked in the southwest, is why is norovirus such a challenge in this part of the country? And we are different to the rest of England in terms of the age of our population. The southwest of England, particularly Devon and Cornwall, is somewhere that people come for their holidays. There are lovely beaches. There's a beautiful coastline. There's good surfing beaches in the north of the county. And then many people, when they retire, decide to move to the southwest because the climate is a little milder than the rest of the country. And if you have a look at the graph on this next slide, this indicates the number of 80s per thousand of the population, firstly for England, but also for the southwest region. And you can see in 2013 where the number of over 80s per thousand population is in the southwest. And you can see that we are 20 years ahead of the rest of England. Now, if I was to show you the same graph for my immediate geographical area that I serve as an infection control nurse, there are some small towns in East Devon where the rest of England won't catch up with the proportion of over 80s until 2075. Just a phenomenally elderly population in this part of the country. And therefore, it's probably not surprising that we see a significant number of elderly patients admitted to hospital with symptoms of diarrhea and vomiting. So we know that we've got an increase in the retired population. That is the case across England. That means we've got an increase in frail older people. And together with those frail older people, we've seen an increase in delirium and dementia. And if I look at my own particular hospital, which is approximately 850 beds and includes maternity and children's services, as well as general adult services, 560 of our inpatients, or two-thirds of them, are over 65 years of age, and a third of the patients are over 80. So having specific elderly care wards, we do have them, but actually if you go onto any ward except maternity and our children's ward, you're going to see a significant proportion of patients who are over 80 years of age. And on top of that, about half of our adults will be disorientated during the course of their stay. And that makes source isolation of patients with suspected gastroenteritis incredibly challenging and actually sometimes impossible. And that must be also the case in social care settings. It's certainly an issue for us here in healthcare, where you have a very elderly but mobile patient with dementia to try to keep them in a side room at all times is nigh on impossible. So the question is often asked, every winter I'm asked this by various managers and senior medical staff, does it really matter? Does norovirus matter? After all, it's a mild self-limiting illness, isn't it? And if you Google norovirus infection and read the information that's generally available to lay people, that's what's described, mild self-limiting illness, lasts a day or two, make sure that you don't get dehydrated and all will be well. But of course, we know that isn't always the case. And if you go on to the next slide, there were some severe outcomes have been highlighted by Defe et al. Just last year in relation to the genogroup 2, genotype 4 strain of norovirus. And what that paper discusses is the fact that serious illness and death in patients who are admitted to hospital with norovirus with this particular genogroup is a much greater risk than other types of norovirus. My local experience is that whereas the information lay people tend to read is that symptoms will last a day or two, the duration of symptoms in hospital is on average 5 days. And we certainly have seen elderly patients who continue to have symptoms for up to 2 weeks. It results as a minimum in an extended length of stay. And with elderly patients, we often see the impact of them being admitted dehydrated, or if they've acquired norovirus whilst they're in hospital, becoming dehydrated very rapidly, particularly if they're vomiting. They're then rehydrated. Their symptoms seem to cease, but then they relapse about 3 days after resolution of the original symptoms. And we see that again and again in our elderly patients. And I've got some specific examples on this slide of the impact on elderly service users. In my hospital, we had an elderly lady admitted to us a few years ago now. She was on a coach holiday to the southwest from somewhere up north, obviously decided to come down in the winter months, hoping the weather would be a bit milder, with a whole coach load of other people. And there was vomiting on the coach, there was vomiting in the hotel they were staying in, and this lady was eventually admitted to hospital, where they thought she had a ruptured aortic aneurysm and took her to theatre, where it was discovered that actually it was a perforated esophagus that she had because she had vomited so much, and she spent 2 weeks in ITU. She also managed to infect during the theatre side of things, and also in ITU, 25 members of staff. But the majority of them were in the operating theatre during firstly what they thought was the aortic aneurysm repair, so that was one surgical team, and then when it was recognised it was a perforated esophagus, passed over to the appropriate surgeon for that, and another surgical team. So two surgical teams exposed to the virus despite wearing masks, and a really high hit rate. We see patients who've got esophageal varices who will bleed. Those varices start bleeding as a result of the vomiting. We see multiple patients, elderly patients, who vomit at home and then are admitted with hematemesis because the vomiting has gone on so long, so they've got a tear. And we also see elderly people with aspiration pneumonia as a result of the vomiting. And finally, it sounds a little amusing, but it clearly isn't at all. We did have a patient who had such profuse diarrhea that she slipped in her diarrhea because she had been incontinent on the floor, fell and fractured her neck of femur, and did result in, again, obviously surgery and ITU stay because she was so debilitated before she fell and fractured her femur. And she did survive, but not the sort of outcome that you'd expect from a mild self-limiting illness. So norovirus is serious. Norovirus does cause serious illness, and particularly for vulnerable people such as the elderly. If we look at the epidemiology of the outbreaks that we've experienced in Exeter and East Devon, I'm only going to go back as far as 2009-10, the winter of 2009-10, but I could go back for many years and show you a similar picture, but it has got worse over the last decade. And in 2009-10 we had almost continuous outbreaks affecting the hospital from November through to the spring of the following year. There were peaks and troughs, but it was almost constant that we had wards closed. And at the peak of these outbreaks we had 12 wards closed at any one time. At that stage we only had 36 wards in the hospital, so that's a third of the wards that we have to admit patients to were closed to admissions as a result of norovirus outbreaks. The impact of that just over the worst 5 months was that we lost 2,350 bed days. I am on to the next slide now. 740 elective patients were had their surgical cases cancelled on the day of admission. At that point, that was what was recorded accurately, were those cases that were cancelled on the day of admission, but there were many others that had to be cancelled in advance. Length of stay increased, and that was particularly for patients who were due to transfer to other care settings, such as care homes or community hospitals, but couldn't go because they were trapped on a ward where an outbreak was ongoing. And even when they had symptoms and recovered themselves, there was a reluctance by those other care providers to take the patient, even though their own symptoms, those symptoms had resolved. There was even a reluctance from social care professionals to visit wards that were affected by an outbreak to assess patients, so that when the outbreak was at its end, that patient could be transferred swiftly to the desired care setting. That was despite offering, separate facilities for the patient to be assessed in, rather than having to actually enter the ward where the outbreak was. And what was the impact on staff? Well, what we see along with the outbreaks is an increase in diarrhea and vomiting amongst hospital staff. And if you go to the next slide, you can see that actually all year round we see members of staff off sick because of diarrhea and vomiting. But as the number of ward outbreaks increase, not surprisingly, the number of ward staff who are affected by norovirus also increases. But what you can also see from this graph is the numbers of staff off sick rises just before the number of wards increases. So this is almost our early warning for when we know norovirus is with us. Most of our staff live in the local community. They don't travel very far to work. So it's quite a good indicator for us to know when we're likely to see patients being admitted with noroviruses, when our sickness rates due to diarrhea and vomiting increase. The other early warning system we have is how many members of staff have to take a day off because their children are off school with diarrhea and vomiting. That's quite a good indicator as well. So after the winter of 2009-10, clearly we needed to tighten up on how we were managing norovirus. We felt that we had failed our patients and failed the organisation, failed the patients who had to have their elective admissions cancelled. And we asked our local health protection unit to try and provide us with early warning data, but actually that wasn't very successful. And as I've said, our own staff sickness and also children of staff being affected in local schools, it has proven to be a much more accurate early warning for us. And also what's going in other hospitals in the southwest. And we all liaise with each other on a daily basis, updating each other on whether or not we've got any wards closed. Obviously, we have a turnover of staff, although we're quite a stable workforce, but certainly junior doctors change on a regular basis. So there was a need to flag up with the clinical staff to remind them what the control measures were for norovirus, and all ward sisters and matrons received a written update. We sent out PowerPoint presentations to lead nurses to cascade to their clinical teams. We provided additional updates for linked nurses and medical staff. We, for the first time, put together a business case for outbreak scrubs, which were a different colour to the normal hospital uniform. And that wasn't so much about the fact that the scrub suits themselves would prevent infection. It was about being, they're quite an obvious colour, they're sort of a raspberry colour, and it was to be able to spot the members of staff that left their outbreak ward and decided that they would wander the hospital. And it had an instant impact of making sure that didn't happen, and also and if people wanted to leave the ward, they had to get changed in order to do so. We provided additional cleaning services for affected wards, and all the outbreak resources, signage, hand washing resources and so on our intranet were updated. The layout of the wards in my hospital is that we have two wards together on a template with some shared facilities such as the kitchen, the ward kitchen, the cleaning storeroom where the cleaning trolleys are kept for both wards and the cleaning products. There's one staff toilet between the two wards. And if changing rooms are available for staff, again, they're shared. So we looked at how we could lock down if one ward became affected on a template, because what we've seen in previous winters was that if one ward on a template became affected by norovirus, it spread across. And we felt it was because of these shared areas. So we put plans in place for how toilet facilities for staff, the kitchen could be off limits to staff from the affected ward, and that cleaning trolleys and products could be kept separately to avoid this sharing across the template. Some of these measures that I'm going to describe on the next slide are around both patient and staff movement, and these were already in theory in place, but in practice really needed to be tightened up. So cleaning staff were an issue, and what we wanted is that cleaning staff would be strictly allocated to a closed ward only, and that they would not go anywhere else. And what we were finding, although it shouldn't have been happening, was that cleaning staff may be moved from one ward to another if another ward was short, even if the second ward they went to didn't have an outbreak at that stage. So really strictly allocated to the closed wards only. We looked at how we could limit the movement of peripatetic staff, so the medical staff, the doctors, but also allied health professionals such as physiotherapists and occupational therapists. And where possible, we had dirty teams, as they called themselves. That wasn't an expression that we used, but physiotherapists and occupational therapists who would be allocated, if we had multiple wards affected, to those wards and not others. We had, again, this was a self term that was introduced, dirty doctors, who again were allocated in the out-of-hours periods where obviously you've got fewer numbers of doctors covering the hospital, doctors allocated to affected wards, and they didn't go to the unaffected wards. Where if we had only closed a bay on a ward rather than closing the whole ward to admissions because there were only symptomatic patients in one bay, where possible, nurses were allocated to work in that bay only. And this is one of the challenges in our healthcare system, is having enough nurses to be able to achieve that. And even if it's achievable during the day, come the night time, the numbers on the night shift are lower, and it's incredibly difficult to be able to guarantee that will be the case. And however careful the nursing staff are with their PPE and their hand washing, clearly if they're moving from an affected bay to an unaffected bay, there is the potential, given the very low inoculum that's required, that they will carry that virus with them. We're very clear that there's no discharges to care homes and community hospitals from the infected bays and wards unless the patient has had and then recovered from norovirus infection. But as I described earlier, there is even in that situation a great reluctance for another provider to accept that transfer. And where it does happen, it's undertaken with discussion between my infection control team and the area that are receiving the patient. Movement of patients from ward to ward to cohort. This is something that's described in the national guidance in England around where you have multiple wards closed to admissions because there are norovirus outbreaks. You over time end up with lots of empty beds, but across several wards. And often what it means is if you can cohort or decant patients from one ward into the empty beds on other wards, you can clean and reopen a whole ward. That does mean that some patients end up trapped on an affected ward for much longer than necessary. So we try not to do that unless our capacity for emergency admissions is threatened. Unlike many parts of England, there's 40, 50 miles between hospitals in Devon and the rest of the southwest. And if one hospital can't take admissions, it's not necessarily the right thing. Well, it isn't the right thing to close the hospital to admissions, because the journey to the next acute hospital through narrow country Devon lanes is really makes the transfer much longer than it should be. So it's the last resort for us to decant patients to free up a whole ward, but sometimes it has to be done if it means that the other option is to close the whole hospital to admissions. We advise symptomatic staff to remain absent until they're symptom-free for at least 48 hours. And we have certainly had members of staff who have come back earlier, but there is recognition amongst their colleagues that that's not the right thing to do, and that tends to be reported and they're sent away again. But there is a desire to come back to work because they know that their colleagues are short-staffed without them, but of course it doesn't do their colleagues any favours if they pass on the infection. When it comes to reopening wards where there's been outbreaks of norovirus, the decision to reopen is only made by the infection control team here in this hospital, and usually by myself or my infection control doctor colleague. We don't reopen the ward until 72 hours after cessation of uncontained symptoms. So either all patients have ceased to be symptomatic for 72 hours, or the last patients to be symptomatic have been contained within an isolation room, and it's effective isolation. It's not moving somebody into an isolation room who is confused and is likely to wander out. And when 72 hours have passed with that situation, we clean and reopen. We have a specialist cleaning team, which we try to give 24 hours notice to of the need for a terminal clean wherever possible. And they are usually able to complete a terminal clean within one working day. As I said earlier, we use a chlorine-releasing agent as per the national guidelines, but we also use hydrogen peroxide vapour to disinfect the environment if Clostridium difficile has also been a factor. So the impact of putting some more stringent measures in place appeared to work. If you move on to the next slide, you can see 2009-10 again there with 12 wards at a time closed, and then you can look at 2010-11 and the winter period on the right-hand side of the graph. St- still had outbreaks, still had multiple ward outbreaks, but much less impact than the previous winter. And we thought, hallelujah, we've achieved what we wanted to achieve. Yes, we're still getting outbreaks, but the impact is much less on both patients and the hospital. But some key issues remained. If you move on to the next slide, please. We were still missing possible cases in our medical admission unit, but that was happening less frequently. Movement of patients remained a significant issue, with outlying medical patients to surgical beds because we didn't have enough medical beds for the volume of patients being admitted as emergencies. We still do see elderly patients who appear to have resolved, their symptoms have resolved, and we're on the 72-hour countdown to reopening, and then on day three, the symptoms reemerge. We call it a relapse, but it's probably related to the patient having been dehydrated despite attempts to rehydrate effectively, but that is a feature with our elderly patients. We also really wanted to emphasise the need to transfer patients out of our acute medical admissions unit so that they weren't remaining in an area, even though they were in an isolation room, with other patients who would then be admitted to lots of different wards across the hospital. But that became particularly challenging in the winter of 2010-11 because we had competing pressures associated with flu. So we were between the devil and the deep blue sea as to what we prioritised in terms of isolation. But the positive was that we had no outbreaks in other organisations as a result of transfers out from the RD&E, and we did, sorry, the RD&E is the abbreviation for my hospital, and we did have, there was a lesser impact on the number of ward closures. And then, if you move on to the next slide, we had summer outbreaks. So we had a better winter, but actually we had a worse summer. And in June and July, we saw two clear outbreaks occur, affecting up to six wards at a time. If you move on to the next slide, please. We asked ourselves why. Why was this? And it's summertime complacency. Norovirus doesn't go away. It is there all year round, but it seems to cause a greater problem. Well, it does cause a greater problem in the winter months, but it doesn't mean it's not there in our local community during the summer months. And certainly we have seen outbreaks in campsites and holiday parks and so on in the summer months. So it is not to wonder that it affected us in the hospital. So we had more focused work, particularly in the admissions ward, working with the staff there, with the site practitioners, the infection control team started then and continue to undertake a frequent review of admissions coming through the emergency departments into the medical admissions unit in order to try and identify the cases that are not obvious, that might get missed, which means that we place patients in isolation who don't need to be, but we do have norovirus testing on site, and it means we can get rapid results within the day. And therefore remove those patients from single room isolation at the earliest opportunity. So if you move on to the next slide, you can see 2011-12, the summer outbreak. We were worried that we were going to have that a summer outbreak might herald a really a really appalling winter time, but actually it was the best winter we'd had for many, many years. And we felt that our additional measures had done the trick, and then we hit last winter, 2012-13, and we were back to one of the worst winters since 2009-10, although it was over a shorter period of time, really from December through to February, whereas in 2009-10 it was almost 6 months before we were free of norovirus. What was the issue here, and what was the issue back in 2009-10? New strains of norovirus appeared to be the issue, and more people affected by a more virulent strain of norovirus. We certainly were seeing, at the peak of this, probably 20 to 30 patients a day admitted with suspected gastroenteritis, and that had a huge pressure in terms of trying to find isolation facilities for those patients. New guidance came out in 2012 in this country, and there were two key differences in this guidance that differ from our local practice. Firstly, the guidance says, and undoubtedly other hospitals elsewhere in the country have managed it, that you can manage outbreaks in small cohorts, so just closing bays, not whole wards, successfully. It's not our experience. And certainly, and the other difference was that you could reopen after terminal cleaning at 48 hours after resolution of the last case, and our practice was 72 hours. So if we look at the extent and duration of closure here in my hospital, we take an early ward, whole ward closure approach on any ward where we can't identify the source of the index cases norovirus. So they're not a patient who's come in with it. They might have been on the ward for many days and then they become symptomatic. We can't see where they have acquired it from, and therefore it's unknown how many other patients might have been exposed. The other time when we go for early whole ward closure is where there's already more than one case at the time of reporting, or the first patient that's identified is confused, and given our elderly population, that's very common, that the index case is confused and has already wandered around the ward and might have exposed other patients outside their bay, or the first patient, despite being not being confused, has been sharing toilet facilities with patients in other bays. So in those situations, we would go for early ward closure, and we keep the ward closed to admissions, and we limit the movement out of that ward unless it's clinically necessary to move somebody out. We keep that duration of the closure until 72 hours after resolution or containment of the last case. And if we look at our experience last winter, 14 of the 26 outbreaks that we experienced resulted in full ward closure at the outset. Five of the 26 wards initially had one bay closed, but it spread to other bays, resulting in subsequent full ward closure. And where we closed the full ward early on, what we saw was a shorter duration of closure than if we started off with one bay and then had to close the whole ward. And in fact, it was over 2 days less by going for full ward closure at the outset. We did have seven outbreaks that were confined to one bay only, and that was where cohort nursing was implemented 24 round the clock, so early shift, late shift, night shift. Dedicated staff were able to be allocated to that bay and stay in that bay, but we still restricted transfers out from the rest of the ward, even though we were able to cohort that bay effectively. So what was the impact last winter? Well, 285 symptomatic patients. We still lost over 1,000 bed days. Was this failure? I don't think it was, because we didn't see any spread from medical wards to surgery. We didn't cancel any elective surgical activity because there was no spread to the surgical wards. And we didn't have any known spread to care homes or community hospitals. So from that perspective, it was successful. And I just want to move on to the last slide now, by way of a conclusion. Obviously, norovirus vaccines are being talked about and they're being tested. And I can see that in an area, a geographic area like my own, with the elderly demographic that we have, without a norovirus vaccine, combined with outbreak control measures and good routine infection control practice, norovirus will continue to be a challenge. And as the elderly population and the confused elderly population increases, we will see more and more patients needing admission to hospital if they haven't been vaccinated. And because of the challenges of being able to isolate confused elderly people, we will see spread, and therefore we will see outbreaks. We're still not sure here whether it's luck or judgment when the number of outbreaks one winter is lower than the previous year. And that's because it's confounded by new strains being experienced, and that appears to result in the numbers of outbreaks going up. Our local experience is that the duration of a ward closure due to an outbreak is less if you close at the earliest opportunity, but I know that that is different to the experience in other parts of this country, and it would be interesting to know what the experience is in other parts of the world. And it is possible to implement full ward closure whilst minimising the impact on business as usual in the hospital, and we saw that last winter by being able to maintain our elective admissions for surgery, for instance. And finally, I'd just like to say that not all national guidance is helpful, and in particular, the two recommendations within the national guidance that was published in 2012 in this country around not closing whole wards and reopening 48 hours after resolution of the last symptomatic patient is not helpful in an area where we know that doesn't work with our elderly population. And whilst it is only guidance, and what we're doing is more than the guidance recommends, there can be pressure from commissioners of care to follow the guidance rather than to base our control measures on what we know will work for our local population. But I think we do have enough evidence to show that what we need to do here in this setting. And the elderly population does make us significantly different to many other parts of the country, and it's that that we have to keep highlighting, and the particular issues around nursing elderly patients with dementia who have got diarrhoea and vomiting. Thank you very much for listening to me. I have to say it's a very strange experience, not knowing how many or who I'm talking to, but I have enjoyed it, and I hope you've enjoyed listening.
Judy, thank you very much. We have indeed enjoyed listening. It's very practical, the things that you discussed, and it's great to learn from your experience. I wanted to ask you, forgive me if you mentioned this and I didn't hear it, are there no isolation rooms or private rooms into which infected patients can be moved?
There are. So a typical NHS ward, we still have some hospitals in the UK that have large, what we call Nightingale wards, where you might have 30 patients all in one big room. But most hospitals that have been built in the last 30, 40 years comprise small bays with 4-6 beds in them and a small number of single rooms. So, for instance, in our wards, we have 28 beds, and 4 of those will be single rooms. Not all of them with ensuite facilities. It's about 20% of our beds are in single rooms in my hospital, which is not enough to keep pace with the volume of patients being admitted who might have norovirus, when you've also got other patients with other infectious conditions that warrant isolation as well. You have to make a risk assessment of who warrants admission to a single room, and sometimes that risk assessment, you get it wrong, and then you get spread.
It's an ongoing challenge. It's exactly right. It's not an easy job. You've been at it for, I won't say how many years, but you've been very successful in your career, and I thank you very much for taking this time with us. Before we close, I'd like to thank and acknowledge our patron sponsors, Virox Technologies, the World Health Organization, and the Center for Research for Environmental Microbiology at the University of Ottawa. These folks provide us with funding and moral support and support in many ways, and I'm very grateful to them, because teleclass education is run entirely by volunteers, including myself, and on a not-for-profit basis. So their sort of support is very important. Thank you to all of you who have joined us today. And Judy, thank you again. I've enjoyed that very much, and we'll talk to you all again very soon, I hope. Thank you very much. Goodbye.